Inside the foil is a single truffle and a slice of foie gras. As the truffle is warmed in the oven, the foie gras melts into it. He unwrapped the foil and bent his head in appreciation. Mmm, you smell that. Bennett followed instructions and took in the complex, ripely aromatic puff of warm air that escaped from the open foil. The black, lumpy shape of the truffle glistened with melted fat, ugly, delicious, and outrageously expensive.
Best-selling author Peter Mayall, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. Peter Mayall is here to talk about food and culture in the south of France. He'll speak with Priscilla Ferguson, a recent scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center and a professor of French and sociology at Columbia University. Peter Mayall is an expatriate Englishman who nowadays divides his time between the south of France and Long Island. By writing a series of books inspired by the Côte d'Azur and Provence, Peter Mayall has become a best-selling author with an international following. In 1990, he published A Year in Provence, which won the British Book Award for Best Travel Book of the Year. This was followed by Toujours Provence, Hotel Pastis, and A Dog's Life. With the publication last spring of his third novel, Anything Considered, Peter Mayall continues his celebration of the food and culture of the south of France. When he visited the National Humanities Center, I invited him to sit down for a conversation with Priscilla Ferguson, one of the center's resident scholars. Priscilla Ferguson is at work on a new study of French culinary culture and its importance worldwide.
Expatriatism is a theme in all of these works, both the novels and in the memoirs. And you're telling me that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work.
Well, it certainly hasn't worked for a couple of people whom we know. And the reason it hasn't is because they thought that just moving was going to be a sufficient interest to keep them occupied and amused for the rest of their lives, which of course it isn't. You've got to have something, you've got to carry something along with you in the way of an interest or an occupation of some sort. And it can be anything from growing roses to taking pictures to drawing, painting rather bad watercolours. But it has to be something that you can, you have to have some sort of resource, an intellectual resource. Otherwise you go mad and drink the bottles more quickly even than one does normally.
When one thinks of expatriatism, one thinks of people wandering from place to place, but in fact, what comes through in all your books is an enormously strong attachment to place, to this particular home of yours in Provence, and perhaps you say
yes,
something about that.
It's
that
funny.
You made the place your own with all the work done and on it.
Well,
your neighbors.
It's one of those very few times when you go to somewhere strange and you realize that you've come home, and I can't explain it better than that. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those places where we both felt just very
much. How did you go to Provence in the first place?
It was by luck, because as most English people do, when we used to come on vacation to France, we just point the cars and go as fast as we could down to the beach and the coast, stay there for 2 weeks, baste ourselves like a couple of sardines, and then at the last possible minute, belt back to London. Mm-hmm. And then somebody said, you're missing a treat if you don't go and have a look in the back country. One day we were down on the coast and it was a rather damp day. And so we got in the car and did some exploring and arrived at a village called Gourde in the Luberon, which is just a stunning looking village. And
a stunning village sort of hanging off a
cliff.
Yes,
it's a village perché, and it's right on the top so that your neighbors can't pour boiling oil on you in times of strife and trouble. And just fell in love with it. The light and the mountains and the slowness of it and the emptiness of it, which I find very nice. But to go back to people trying to establish themselves there, I mean, those are the sort of things in the winter that make the emptiness and the slow rhythm of life. Those are the things that get people who are used to a quick urban life with a lot of companionship. They can't have a great deal of difficulty taking that, I think.
In all of your works, food plays an immense role. This last book, Anything Considered, tells you right off on the cover is a place setting with plates and the requisite number of knives and forks and spoons to get through a considerable French French meal. I read recently in the Times Literary Supplement a review of English cooking shows on television, which seems a bit odd, but where the person referred to cookbooks as fairy tales for grown-ups. I wonder if you'd like to comment on your works as presenting through food certain amount of fairy tales for grown-ups.
Well, I would defend the food writing that I do in the books. I don't ever write about a place that I haven't been to. Mm-hmm. If it's not good, I don't write about it. I don't try to write about it as a food critic, you know, and sort of analyze the ingredients and the cooking times and the degree of the sauce, the unctuousness of the sauce. I just like to convey the atmosphere of what it's like to eat in a certain place and what you eat while you're there. And I like writing about meals, partly because I just find it amusing and partly because it's a very good literary device for characters to talk to each other and either make plans or have arguments or fall in love or threaten each other, whatever. And also it's part of normal life. And I think to establish characters, you need to put in quite a lot of detail. And one of the important details about characters, I think, is what they like to eat and how they eat it.
The interest of food for me is that it's, to write about it as well as to eat, is that it's both intensely personal and dramatically social. And I think that comes across in a lot of the meals that you have in your works. I've eaten in some of the specific places, but more often places very much like the meals that that you describe. And we should say that in the current work, the new novel, A Truffle Scam, is the sort of central plot device. But in fact, truffles turn up in a fair number of places in the earlier works. Perhaps you could talk about the truffle mania.
I didn't know anything about them, really, until we came to live in Provence. And then I happened to talk to the fellow who was plastering the ceilings, was my professor at the time, and started telling me about how you look for a fly with red eyes and you look for a burnt patch around the bottom of oak trees and things. And that got me fairly interested. And then a friend of ours who was a chef at a restaurant got hold of some truffles and cooked a truffle omelette for us, which was a sort of eye-opening, revelatory experience. And then I started getting very interested in them, not only because of their delicious flavor and wonderful smell and everything, but because of the furtive way in which they're traded and bought and sold, and the sort of skullduggery that goes on in the business, because
right, the connections between people bringing in and painting or dyeing Italian white truffles.
Oh yes, well they had the white truffles from Senegal that they stained with.
Oh, from Senegal, yeah, with Italy,
absolutely
one thing,
tasteless, and they stained them black. And there was a huge scandal in Carpentras, which is the center of local truffle trade, some years ago, because they'd been found out, having some very reputable dealers had been found out as having doctored the goods. Anyway, it occurred to me that it would be very interesting to see what would happen in terms of a fictional story if you took as the starting off point something which is sort of feasible, which is the discovery of a formula to cultivate truffles, which the French government has actually been trying to do off and on for about 20 years, I think.
So it really has been trying to do.
Oh, yes. No, there have been studies, there have been experiments. I mean, you can go around the Vaucluse now and still see what they call truffle stations, which is sort of fields with very, very skimpy little tiny oak trees that are not going to be anything for 20 years. I thought, well, if anybody does ever find a way of cultivating these things, which still are found wild by dogs mainly now rather than pigs, they would be sitting on a small fortune. So with that, I thought, well, obviously the person who has it ought to be a villain, and then he ought to lose it, and then the hero ought to get involved in the contest to get it back. So that was really what set me off.
Perhaps you would like to read from the book a couple of the passages on truffles to convey some of the both the sensual qualities and also the larger sort of cultural sense of where truffles fit in the French gastronomic lexicon.
Do you want us to eat them first?
I think we start eating them, and then as we digest our truffles, we can move into the considering the cultural relevance.
Well, this is at a point in the plot where our hero, who's called Bennett, is invited to the chateau belonging to the villain, whose name is Julian Poe, to discuss the advertisement that Bennett's put in the Herald Tribune, where he offers himself up for work. And Julian Poe has a proposition for him, but before he gets to the proposition, they go in to eat what Julian Poe says is the last dinner of winter before the spring comes, because of the seasonal nature of truffles. You can't eat them all through the year. So they're just going into the dining room. The serving girl had placed large white plates in front of them. On each plate, incongruous against the plain elegance of the porcelain, was a foil-wrapped packet, a little smaller than a tennis ball. "The presentation is a little homespun," said Poe, "but it's practical. Inside the foil is a single truffle and a slice of foie gras. As the truffle is warmed in the oven, the foie gras melts into it." He unwrapped the foil and bent his head in appreciation. "Mmm, you smell that." Bennett followed instructions and took in the complex, ripely aromatic puff of warm air that escaped from the open foil. The black, lumpy shape of the truffle glistened with melted fat, ugly, delicious, and outrageously expensive. Bennett judged his to be a good quarter of a pound, or $100, at friend's prices. "Wonderful, isn't it?" said Poe. "Now put a good pinch of that on it." He pointed to a small silver dish in front of Bennett's plate. "It's fleur de sel, comes from the Gironde. They harvest it every summer. It's the best salt in France." Bennett sprinkled the coarse, greyish-white salt over the truffle, cut off a slice, and bit into it. He'd eaten truffles before, but never anything this big, this rich, or this self-indulgent. And there is another little piece, if perhaps I could just read about which goes into in a very minor way into the importance of the truffle in French gastronomy. And Bennett's thinking over this job that he's taking, and is fascinated by the fact that Poe seems to be so bound up in truffles. Bennett's own knowledge of truffles was not altogether limited to the occasional extravagant meal. It was impossible to live in France for any length of time without becoming aware of the importance, indeed reverence, with which these pungent fungi were regarded. They were the black, misshapen jewels in the crown of La France gastronomique. Their prices were reported in newspapers. Their quality, which varied from year to year, was discussed in bars and restaurants all over the country. Their superiority over the white Italian truffle was proclaimed by patriot gourmets from Lille to Carcassonne, and God help anyone who disagreed. In Anglo-Saxon countries, cleanliness is said to rank next to godliness. But the French give the stomach precedence over soap and water, and the truffle is an icon. In fact, it was not unknown for the village church at Saint-Martin to hold a truffle mass in celebration of a particularly good season. In other words, truffles were very close to being sacred objects, with the added allure of being impossibly, riotously expensive, or, with the right connections, free.
Very good. Our discussion on food makes me think of my own work in looking at food and the role it plays in contemporary society. And I was wondering if you would ascribe the popularity of your work. I first got my first copy of one of your books from my mother, who immediately saw it and said, "Ah, that's what you have to do, food in France. This is a book you need." To a sort of a growth in culinary consciousness in, say, at least in the United States over the past 25, 30 years.
Yes, I've noticed that enormously because I first came over here when I was 21, which was a considerable time ago. And at that time, beginning of the 60s, yeah, it must have been, you outside of New York and possibly San Francisco, you would be very lucky to find anything that wasn't straight up and down American cooking, whereas now in the most unlikely places you find wonderful restaurants. And it's becoming a little bit more like France in that respect. I mean, you place Alice Waters, is it, in mm-hmm. Berkeley. It's not the sort of place you would imagine to find a really brilliant restaurant, but they're happening more and more. And I suspect that you're right. I think I've been helped by the extra interest in food, the fact that Americans are possibly traveling a little bit more than they used to.
As I notice in the back of one of the books is a blurb from Julia Child, and she has been riding the same wave, and indeed part of it. And she's also has a place in Provence.
Yes. But whereas, you know, one of my great literary heroines, M.F.K. Fisher, was very much out on her own when she was out in Marseille and Aix. It's much more common now to see American expatriates and certainly much more common to see American tourists and visitors in Provence now. And so to that extent, I think I was very lucky to write what I did when I did it, because I think I was just fortunate in the timing.
I notice now you spend quite a bit of time in Long Island. How would you compare Long Island in gastronomic terms for Provence?
Well, we tend to spend our time there during the winter. Mm. And what is wonderful there is the fish. Fish is very good. The produce is actually good too. Ducks, chickens are good. It's a totally different kind of cuisine, obviously, as much as they will describe it in Italian terms or French terms. It is actually American cooking, and very good it is too. But the thing that I do miss, actually, is the cheese more than anything else, because there really isn't very much in the way of cheese in America. But there are some wonderful cooks up there, some very nice restaurants, and, as I said, there's some absolutely marvellous fish stores, which we don't get, of course, in Provence. We get a van that comes around every Tuesday, and it may or may not have anything decent, depending on the week. So,
but food or gastronomy isn't a way of life that it is.
In
France.
I've noticed so much that food is treated, especially in the middle of the day, as fuel, just to sort of keep you going while you finish off your work day. Whereas, as you know, in France, everything stops for 2 hours at 12 o'clock and people sit down and relax a bit and work later in the evening to make up for the time. But they do insist on lunch. No, in Long Island, I guess all over America, I mean, you're quite likely to see people sitting in their pickup trucks eating a sandwich. Whereas their equivalent in France would go to a restaurant.
The chefs, French chefs in New York, whom I've interviewed, say they had to get used to the hour and a quarter for lunch required for their business customers who are their primary customers at lunch.
I think it's such a waste, too. I'd rather not have it.
But it's wonderful to go to a top restaurant at lunch because, A, there are fewer people, B, it's less expensive, and C, you can spend there for the spend the afternoon there.
Yes, and they'll be quite, very, very
quite,
pleased with
quite
you,
happily,
too.
Yeah. Quite happily, happily so. I'd like you to say something about your writing in your hero. Bennett is not a writer, but you are very definitely a writer. And how did Provence start you on this kind of writing?
It started me on this kind of writing. Yes, I had written some children's books and some shorter books about various things, the British licensing hours and advertising and things like that. And I didn't know whether I was going to be capable of doing anything else than that. But I did have an idea for a novel when we first moved out to France, and that's what I was planning to do, to just have a go. And then I got distracted on the day-to-day curiosities of life out there.
And getting your house ready.
Getting the house ready. And I ended up writing two books in order to avoid having to deal with writing the novel. So I distracted myself that way. And I have to say that I just enjoyed it so much. I wasn't really thinking about whether I could do it or whether I couldn't do it. I just had an enthusiasm to write it down and to impart what we were going through.
Did it feel
so
strange to be writing in English in the midst of another language?
Not really, no. Because our life was and still is conducted in a sort of mixture of French and English. And I think it was good that I wrote the first book while I did, which was pretty much as it was all happening, because now I'm so much more used to the way people are, and it doesn't strike me with quite the same freshness. But you can never say a book wrote itself, but I really wanted to get at it every day and work on it. It was certainly wasn't a chore at all, as some writing is, even when you're on the whole enjoying it. Well, there are some moments in a novel, for instance, when you're about halfway through and you think, am I ever going to finish this damn thing? Is it ever going to work out?
The popularity has been gratifying, as you describe, in Toujours Provence, of getting letters and so forth, but other aspects have been less so. People driving up your garage and your driveway and installing themselves on the edge of the swimming pool, expecting words of wisdom, words of...
Usually expecting a drink, I think.
That's probably one disadvantage of writing so much about
right.
food.
Glass of pink wine and a photograph is what they usually like, and then to sign a book or something. Yes, that has been, for the last two or three years, a real problem, because, you know, as nice as most of these people are, and they are very pleasant, you cannot live with constant interruptions. I can't write. My wife can't get on with her photography or cooking or whatever. If you've always got an eye on the front door and not knowing who the hell's going to come through it next. And it was, the final straw for us was we were having lunch from one Sunday with some friends, a couple of friends in the courtyard, and we heard some splashing coming from the swimming pool. And I went round to see what was going on. I thought one of the dogs had fallen in the water. And it was an Italian couple with a video camera wanting Jenny, my wife, and I to get in the pool with them so we could all have our photographs taken together. Mm. And there was not a hint of being abashed at jumping into somebody else's pool or invading somebody else's privacy on a Sunday. And so we have had to take the reluctant step of selling our house and looking for something that's going to be hidden behind a couple of bushes, I think. But certainly a little more secluded than the one that we lived in for 8 years.
Well, one question that certainly comes to mind when one thinks of food in France is le fast food, which has been there for some time, but McDonald's has moved in.
Big Mac. Yeah,
has
le
it Big Mac. Moved into your part of Provence?
It's in Avignon, certainly, and I think probably also Aix. And we have a very nice lady who comes in and helps around the house twice a week called Chantal, and she's about 30, I guess, and she's got a small daughter. And I can see why they're successful, because Chantal thinks it's the most wonderful place for her to go with her daughter and her daughter's little friends, because McDonald's is clean, you know what you're getting, it's consistent, they're used to children, and it's not terribly expensive. So Chantal and all the girls like her who live around are all in favor of it, you see. And I think that's often the funny thing that happens. It's although it takes foreigners perhaps to appreciate what a country has, but the Chantals of this world just grow up and have a completely different perspective on food. And for them, it's just a chore to be stuck in the kitchen for half a day cooking dinner.
What does this mean for the local cafes and the some of the marvelous restaurants that you're talking about? I don't mean Ili, the fancy restaurant in Avignon where you describe going, but the restaurant you went afterward for the routier. There will
always be good places for the routier to go, I think, and there'll always be good bistros. There'll always be good, fine, 4-star restaurants. But I think for, the sort of people who wouldn't eat out very often, I think fast food is an alternative to staying at home and doing it yourself. I don't think it's an alternative to going out to the local bistro. I hope it's not.
I certainly hope not. Well, here's one final footnote. Could you tell us, Peter, about your favorite French meal? That's a hard question to answer, but give it a try.
It's almost impossible to answer because it varies, as you know, from winter to summer. But I remember having a meal which began very much in the way Bennett's meal began, with a truffle and foie gras. Then we had some marcassin, which is a wild boar, but a young wild boar, in a stew that had been made with onions and olives and blood and all that stuff. That was superb. Then there was a salad. Then there were about 3 or 4 cheeses. Then there was a little... They make the very best crème caramel, in France. And then we had coffee and a digestif. But I mean, that's just one out of hundreds. It's very, very difficult to pick the one. Although I do remember a memorable lunch at Trois Gros in Roanne, which went on for 3 hours. And I just felt like ready for a game of tennis afterwards. It was such a wonderfully balanced meal that you didn't feel in the slightest bit bloated.
And wonderfully balanced for the meal, but also the setting, and then you have to take into account the people you're with.
Yeah.
And
there are
so many ingredients to
a and funnily enough, I have to say that I really very much like having occasionally dinner on my own out in a restaurant at a table for one, because then you can concentrate absolutely on the food or eavesdrop on other people's conversations.
Ah, yes, the eavesdropping.
Which is terrific fun in France.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Mayle is the author of A Year in Provence, Hotel Pasty, and A Dog's Life. His third novel, Anything Considered, was published last spring by Knopf. Priscilla Ferguson is a professor of French and sociology at Columbia University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a new study of French culinary culture and its importance worldwide. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. I'll be back in just a moment to tell you where to write for an audio cassette of this program. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Audio tapes are available for $10 post-paid. Write to us for a tape or send us your comments. The address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 841. That's $10, program number 841. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. If you want more information about the National Humanities Center, write to us or call during business hours Eastern Time. The telephone number is area code 919-549-0661. That's area code 919-549-0661. The National Humanities Center is an independent nonprofit institute that seeks to encourage excellence in scholarship, to strengthen teaching, and to broaden public understanding of the humanities. Next week on Soundings, new fiction from writers Brad Watson and William Baldwin. They'll be here with readings and conversation about their new books, Last Days of the Dogmen and The Fennell Family Papers. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs radio service of the National Humanities Center. In Praise of Provence, a conversation with best-selling author Peter Mayle and Priscilla Ferguson of Columbia University, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. By writing a series of books about the south of France, Peter Mayle has become a best-selling author with an international following. His latest novel is Anything Considered, another celebration of the food and culture of his beloved Provence. Peter Mayle will be here this week to talk about his work with Priscilla Ferguson, a resident scholar at the National Humanities Center. In Praise of Provence, a conversation with best-selling writer Peter Mayle and Francophile Priscilla Ferguson, this week on Soundings.